You're listening to 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today you'll hear two interviews from the Write the Book archives. First, a conversation with author and UVM professor Paul Kinstead, and then an interview from the early days of the show with Vermont poet Jody Gladding. Paul Kinstead, PhD, is a professor at the University of Vermont in the Department of Nutrition and Food Sciences. He teaches dairy chemistry, fermented dairy foods, and cheese and culture. We talked in 2012 about his book, Cheese and Culture, A History of Cheese and Its Place in Western Civilization, published by Chelsea Green. Behind every traditional type of cheese, there is a fascinating story. By examining the role of the cheesemaker throughout world history and by understanding a few basic principles of cheese science and technology, we can see how different cheeses have been shaped by and tailored to their surrounding environment, as well as defined by their social and cultural context. Cheese and Culture endeavors to advance our appreciation of cheese origins by viewing human history through the eyes of a cheese scientist. There is also a larger story to be told, a grand narrative that binds all cheeses together into a single history that started with the discovery of cheese making and that is still unfolding to this day. This book reconstructs that 9,000-year story based on the often fragmentary information that we have available. Cheese and Culture embarks on a journey that begins in the Neolithic Age and winds its way through the ensuing centuries to the present. This tour through cheese history intersects with some of the pivotal periods in human prehistory and ancient, classical, medieval, Renaissance, and modern history that have shaped Western civilization. For these periods also shaped the lives of cheesemakers and the diverse cheeses that they developed. The book offers a useful lens through which to view our 21st century attitudes towards cheese that we have inherited from our past and our attitudes about the food system more broadly. This refreshingly original book will appeal to anyone who loves history, food, and especially good cheese. And that's from the publisher's description of the book. But I must say it was a fascinating book. It was so interesting to read about the history of the world through the lens of cheese and where cheese was developed and where it traveled to and the people that made it. I hope you will enjoy my conversation with Paul Kinstead. This was an interview from 2012. I hope you enjoy.
Well, I've always been interested in history. From when I was a young kid in high school, I bought big volumes of history from book clubs, and I love history. And I put all of that behind me and beside for 30 years as I became involved in science and my profession. And really let that atrophy, that love. But then when I began writing my first book, which ultimately led to this course that I developed, Cheese and Culture, that led to the book Cheese and Culture, that gave me an opportunity to actually rekindle that love of history, looking at cheese history, and it was this wonderful opportunity to do something that I love to do and had put aside for a long time and could actually get paid to do it as part of my profession by the marriage of cheese history with the larger history of Western civilization.
Yeah. Now, do you make cheese yourself?
We make it in the laboratory, experimentally for research purposes. I had always, years ago, hoped to start a small cheese-making operation in my home, buy milk from a local farm. I was never going to be a farmer, but I had actually built a house before I was married, and I had plans to have a small cheese-making facility. And then I got married, and then the kids started coming, and life changed, and it never happened. But we do it in the laboratory, and that's been good.
Yeah. And now, what kinds of cheese do you make in the laboratory? All different? Or?
Most of my research over the years has been focused on mozzarella cheese, and we've done a lot of work over the years, more on the very large-scale industrial cheese-making research type of questions and issues. But also some cheddar cheese. And those are what, in terms of my research, we focused on for pilot-scale cheese making. In the Vermont Institute for Artisan Cheese, which is the institute here at UVM that I serve as co-director of, we make all kinds of cheeses.
Mm-hmm. So you're a cheese scientist, as are mm-hmm. your co-workers, I suspect. So what does a cheese scientist do exactly?
Cheese science is an applied science. It's part of the realm of food science, which is simply an area that takes the basic sciences, the chemistry, physics, biochemistry, microbiology, and applies it to, in this case, cheese. So it's really taking many different fields of basic science and using them to understand this particular area of interest, which is cheese. So it's all normal science, but it's very applied.
Okay, and what are your degrees in?
My undergraduate degree, my BS degree, was in dairy technology, which was a very applied, practical type of degree program aimed at training students to become professionals in the dairy industry, in the dairy processing industry, cheese making, milk processing, and so forth. My master's degree was in animal sciences with a dairy science specialization, and particularly dairy chemistry. And my PhD was in food science with dairy chemistry, food microbiology emphasis, okay. and cheese making specifically in terms of my research.
Did you go to UVM for any of those?
I started out as a pre-medical student at the University of Chicago.
Oh, okay.
Realized after a year I didn't want to be in Chicago. Wonderful school, fantastic education, but it just wasn't the right fit at the time. And I didn't want to be a medical doctor. Came to Vermont, just sort of stumbled into this dairy technology major that I mentioned. Stumbled my way through, did well, but didn't quite know what I was going to do after I graduated. Had my resumes printed up to send to milk companies, processing companies.
Okay.
And a faculty member, one of my professors, grabbed me in the hallway and said, "Paul, you really want to go to graduate school?" And so I thought, well, that's a good way to delay this, lifetime choice of career, I'll just stay in school for a couple more years. Master's degree is a research degree, and by the time I finished that two-year master's program, I knew absolutely crystal clear I wanted to do my PhD work specifically in research. I knew who I wanted to work with as a PhD mentor, and I knew where I wanted my career to be, which was at the University of Vermont. And incredibly enough, all those things happened.
Wow.
And it was just this domino of wonderful fulfillments of a dream that I thought, could never happen, but it did.
Yeah.
And I've never looked back, never regretted it.
Yeah. So we've talked about the science of cheese and research. Are there other perks to being a cheese scientist? Do you get to do something that's of more of a culinary nature?
Well, the travel, because much of my early career in research was in mozzarella cheese, mm-hmm. which at the time the pizza industry was just really taking off and exploding, and therefore the cheese producing industry that services the pizza industry was just taking off, and there was very little known in terms of research on mozzarella at that point, and so I was in the right place at the right time to do intense research on this type of cheese and that knowledge was in great demand all over the world, mm-hmm. because pizza was taking over the world, not
yeah.
just America.
Yeah.
And so I had the opportunity to travel and spend extended times, particularly during the summers, on projects in neat places like Australia and Sweden and so forth, Brazil. And so the travel is wonderful. That's one of the wonderful perks of academia in general. If you're in a research area that opens those doors.
Yeah.
Now my emphasis is largely on traditional cheese making, artisanal cheese making, farmstead, and
so you can go to Pennsylvania.
So we do a lot of work with the the folks, the local folks, but also, for example, in January, a new professional association called the Worldwide Traditional Cheesemakers Association was created to bring scientists all from all over the globe who are interested in preserving and protecting and researching traditional cheeses together, and to get them to collaborate and network and so forth. And that was in Sicily. We had a great meeting.
Oh, I bet.
You know, 24 countries represented. And again, you know, to be able to meet colleagues from all over the world and in a very engaging place like Sicily is a wonderful perk.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of good in academia, I have to say. It's a great life.
Yeah, okay, great. You already mentioned this a little bit. You began work on this book, Cheese and Culture, as an offshoot of research that you were doing for another book during a sabbatical. So what was that book, and when was that?
That was 2002 when I went on sabbatical leave for the first time to write American Farmstead Cheese, which was basically a science textbook aimed at this new generation of traditional cheesemakers, artisan farmstead cheesemakers that have arisen, especially in Vermont, but across the country in the last 30 years or so. Mm-hmm. This resurgence, renaissance of traditional cheesemaking, which is so exciting, and we're at the epicenter of that here in Vermont. And I was writing a book to try and distill down, you know, the very complex science of cheese and technology into user-friendly principles, because even artisan cheesemakers who are dedicated to craft and the art need to know something about science to survive in today's cheesemaking environment, mm-hmm. and regulatory environment, and the expectations of the American public. So I was writing this textbook, basically, and I decided as an afterthought that I ought to put in a couple of chapters of history to provide context for why I'm writing this book. Why do we need another textbook on cheese science? There's you look at my office here, and there's tons of textbooks on cheese science, but none of them are really written for this audience, which was very different in terms of their backgrounds and emphasis and so forth. So I said, all right, I'll write a chapter on cheese making in the old world, and then how in the new world in America, how we're the beneficiaries of that legacy, and how this resurgence occurred. And I began to write those two. They were the first two chapters of the book. I was 4 months into my 1 year sabbatical leave, and I realized I could spend the whole year writing about history. And I said, well, what am I going to do? So I said, all right, I have to cut this off and just do the best I can with these two chapters. But when I finish my leave, I want to go back to the University of Vermont and develop a course that integrates cheese science and technology with history, to use my expertise as a lens through which to try and reconstruct history. Because what became evident right away is that there's, cheese history has all these pieces, mm-hmm. with gaps in between them. A lot of, there's been a little bit of good work done on this particular aspect over here and this particular aspect over there, but to integrate it into a narrative that encompasses from start to finish, this history is impossible.
Yeah.
And to recreate that narrative, oftentimes you have to reconstruct likely scenarios of what connected different events and different technologies. How do you get from here to there? And you can sort of reason through using, basic cheese understanding, cheese science and technology principles, to get a sense of what cheesemakers had to have done to get from here to there, and then look at the cultural context and see if it makes sense. And I thought, wow, this would be a great course integrating my area with some of these other areas of anthropology and history, and it turns out all these other areas, climatology and paleo, botany, and on and on and on.
So does the class that you designed involve other professors? Do they come in and talk about their areas, or do you present
That's the next step.
This
has been a lone ranger effort. and the hope is, as I mentioned in the preface of the book, is that this, this book will stimulate interest among scholars in a lot of relevant areas to get together as teams. And we're trying to do this right now, is assemble teams of complementary expertise to begin to tackle some of these issues. Because, it's a story. Cheese and Culture is the first attempt to try and put it all together, but it's not the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, as Churchill said, it's not even the beginning of the end. It's the end of the beginning. I hope it's the start of a new era in looking at this sort of multidisciplinary. And I can't do it alone.
Right.
But I hope we've demonstrated that there's a value in looking at it this way, and there's value in collaborating, because there's really some interesting problems and issues and things to ferret out and to tease out of the past.
Well, it's really interesting, the history of cheese. I found it so fascinating that we can know that Neolithic man started raising goats and sheep for milk at a certain point in the 7th millennium BC, because archaeologists study bone fragments, and they can tell in the bone fragments what these animals were probably raised for. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, and the technology to reconstruct the far distant past, has just advanced, particularly in the last 10 years, and the timing was great for the writing of this book, because there's looking at the bone record that you just mentioned, which has always been sort of the backbone of trying to reconstruct animal husbandry practices and what was going on in terms of the Neolithic peoples raising animals, but that's tricky data to interpret, and it's not always perfectly clear cut. But then when a new technology developed for taking bits of pottery and extracting residues, organic residues that are embedded in the fabric of the pottery that have been there for 9,000 years.
Which is amazing.
That's so amazing. And then being able to use sophisticated radioisotope tracing to sort of get a fingerprint of what the fat source was. Was it animal carcass, or was it milk fat? Was it a plant-derived fat, olive oil? To be able to distinguish what was in that pot 9,000 years ago, that technology is very, very new. And really, it was one pivotal study, a couple that came out in 2005, 2008, that pushed back the origins of dairying and cheesemaking to 7,000 BC, which the bone distribution data that we've talked about are consistent with that. But this really, when you put those two together, plus other artifacts that have arisen in the archaeological strata of that time, pottery shards of specialized pots that make sense in a cheese-making context, sieves and so forth.
Right.
When you start having multiple trains of evidence pointing to the origins of dairying, intensive dairying and cheese-making, you have a lot more confidence that in understanding what was going on. And so that's what I was beginning to uncover in this is 2005. I teach this cheese and culture course that I decided to go back and develop. And by 2008, some of these new technologies, cutting-edge papers are coming out in top-flight science journals. And I'm revising my course every year.
Yeah.
And it just keeps changing.
Yeah.
And I said, wow, I think I can actually write a 9,000-year narrative, because now I know where it begins. And then some other key developments like the genetics to trace back the development of lactose tolerance in human populations,
right, that
comes
was so
online
interesting too. Yeah.
And that just links up a whole bunch of this ancient prehistory period, and you can begin to reconstruct some things that are happening. And so all of a sudden, when I begin to write the book, 2008, and then go on sabbatical leave in 2009. I'm pushed back to not just 7,000 BC, but then, all right, so what is the context that allowed this milk production and dairying system and cheese making to develop? It doesn't just happen out of nowhere. And so I'm pushed back to the Paleolithic.
Yeah.
The amount of research to try and get I'm not a Paleolithic expert, and
right.
So the reading and
so as you discovered, okay, now I need to read in this area. Was that exciting to you, or was it a little overwhelming in writing your book?
For 2 years, I was really 3 years. I was on adrenaline constant. Anybody who knows me from this period, especially my wife, I'd be like, whoa, I just found this, and it was like this succession of really huge pieces that fell into place, and by the time I got done with all this, I'm still trying to recover. I'm exhausted because it was so exciting.
I wonder, Paul, if you can define the Fertile Crescent and talk a little bit about its importance to early cheese production.
Yeah, this is a critical region in human history. It's this pivotal place where agriculture begins. It's in the Near East or Southwest Asia. It's an arc of land that stretches from southern Israel and the Jordan River Valley up through Lebanon and northwestern Syria up into southeastern Turkey, up in the foothills of the Taurus Mountains, and arcing around along the foothills of the Zagros Mountains that separate Iraq from Iran. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Fertile Crescent because it receives enough rainfall for agriculture to occur without irrigation.
Okay.
And it was an environment that was established about 11,000 years ago, about 9,000 BC, and through an amazing shift in global climate that just was astonishing, and that has created the weather patterns that we've had for the last 11,000 years that have been very stable, very human friendly. And one of the first areas that really developed as an area that would support agriculture, that was capable of supporting, you know, human activities in agriculture, was the Fertile Crescent. It was ideally suited for cereal grains, wheat, rye, barley, for legumes to grow wild in wild stands, and that precipitated and enabled agriculture to develop for the first time there with human populations in that region, which then started this snowball effect of cultivation of crops and then herding of animals, domestication of animals, and breeding that led by about 7,000 BC, 2,000 years later, to the you know, intense breeding of animals for dairying, and cheese making begins. So it was this pivotal period.
Okay.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And this is an interview from 2012 with UVM professor and Vermont author Paul Kinstead about his book on cheese and the history of the world as seen through the lens of cheese. We're streaming on 99.3wbtv.org. I hope you're enjoying the conversation.
And so cheese making begins there, and then through migratory patterns it spreads. Did cheese making ever just sort of begin anywhere else as well? Did anyone else come up with it?
That's a great question, and that was one that I grappled with at the beginning. You know, to tell the story of cheese, I like to think in a linear manner, that there's a start, and then there's a progression from that start, and you can follow the thread all the way to today. But of course, if cheese actually arose in multiple locations, then you'd have to have multiple starts and talk about each one.
Right.
And the answer to your question, as best I can tell, is the primary origin of most cheeses in this world, mm-hmm, came out of this Fertile Crescent region. And you can follow the Neolithic people who first discovered cheese making right around that time of 7,000 BC, because of the changes that had taken place in the Fertile Crescent, overpopulation, environmental degradation. You know, people were too successful, and the land could no longer support this, you know, very substantial, unprecedented increase in human populations, and the toll it took on the land. And they began spreading out in all directions, for in some cases thousands of miles. And one can track the movement of dairying and cheese making through the archaeological methods we talked about a few, mm-hmm, moments ago.
Sure.
And follow that progression of cheese technology into different regions. Now, there is a couple of areas where there's growing evidence that cheese making developed independently, and that is the steppes of, you know, the Eurasian region, the Mongolia, and above the Caspian Sea and between the Caspian and the Black Sea, mm-hmm, the Asian steppes, where the development of horses for milking and for the making of dairy products, fermented dairy products, developed independently of the small ruminant sheep and goats and cow dairying. And so there's a, you know, there's a whole group of Mongolian cheeses and from yaks and horses and camels that may have developed independently of. But apart from that, as far there was no cheese making, no dairying in the New World, North America, Central America, or South America until European immigrants brought it. There was no cheese making and dairying in China, in the far east, China, and Southeast Asia.
Okay. Yeah.
So almost all of the cheeses that we know today and that have developed and survived, I think, can be traced back to the Fertile Crescent region.
Okay. All right, great. And in China, cheese making never really took hold even through migratory patterns because they were closed for the most part to other societies and not open to Western foods. And
well, there's a civilization that developed independently of the civilizations that developed out of the Fertile Crescent.
Right.
China had its own civilization. It had its own development of agriculture. This was extremely productive land between the Yangtze River and the Yellow River. I mean, tremendously productive, and supported the development of a great civilization that by 1000 BC to 1000 AD, the current era, when dairying finally makes its way through Iran, Pakistan, through India to China. By the time dairying arrives and cheese making arrives, that Chinese food culture is deeply entrenched, well developed, and very successful, and the Chinese culinary world was very closed, and there was not a terrible need for this new food. Evidently, it was a very thriving culture, and there was some infiltration of cheese making at certain periods, but it was very, very limited,
mm-hmm.
and never really caught hold.
Right, and if you go there today, probably there's not a lot of cheese.
It's coming in because of Western influence,
okay.
and actually China is in a big dairy push, and cheese is included in that, but that's something new.
That's something new that's coming in now.
Now to the north and west of China, Tibet and then Mongolia, those areas have had a long history of dairying yak and other ruminants.
Okay.
But China itself, it's been amazing how little there's been over.
That's so interesting.
9,000 years.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit about rennet coagulation and how it's important to the history of cheese production.
Yeah, the first pivotal step in any cheese making process is this process of coagulation, which transforms liquid milk into a semi-solid gel, like a pudding-like consistency, which then enables a large part of the water phase of the milk, which we call whey, to be separated from the solid phase, which is largely fat and protein and minerals, which becomes cheese. And so coagulation is this critical step to kickstart the cheese-making process. And it turns out there are four basic mechanisms that cheesemakers have developed to do this that are very different mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
And one of these mechanisms is through the use of enzymes that we sort of generically call rennet, that can come from a number of different plant sources or animal sources, traditional animal sources, from the stomachs of animals. And it turns out that the chemistry of the resulting newly made cheeses that can be produced by this type of coagulation, rennet coagulation, can be manipulated with great diversity, so that the resulting cheeses can have very wide ranges of water content and acidity levels,
mm-hmm.
and also fat content. And what that allows is for rennet coagulated cheeses, because they can be produced in such a wide range of chemistries, can during aging or ripening develop in many, many different directions, whereas for the other methods of coagulating milk, they result in a very narrow range of chemistries in that newly made cheese that can only go in a very limited number of directions. So the bottom line is that the vast majority of the cheeses that you'll find in this world, and almost all the aged cheeses, are the result of this rank coagulation. So one of the big questions in history is, who discovered this wonderful new way to coagulate milk that opened the door to all these, to most of the cheeses that we enjoy today?
Mm-hmm.
And when did that happen, and how did it happen? And unfortunately, it probably happened before there was writing, and nobody wrote down, you know, in their journal, "Today I discovered this new way to
yeah, right.
make you know, milk turn into cheese."
Right.
And so we have to try and reconstruct how it may have happened and when it happened. The first definitive evidence for rennet coagulated cheese making doesn't come until about 1500 BC. Cheese making starts 7000 BC, and it isn't until 1500 BC that we have written records that definitively say rennet was really important. Happens to be in Turkey where the first evidence arises, in the Hittite civilization.
Okay.
And by that time, it's deeply entrenched in Hittite culture, based on literary evidence. But undoubtedly, the rennet was discovered long before that and had been, you know, incorporated into the survival strategies for a long time, because it was very important by that time.
Yeah, okay. Now, you mentioned a minute ago curds and whey, you know, and curds is the cheese and whey is the liquid that drains off. So in that famous nursery rhyme where Miss Muffet's eating her curds and whey, why is she eating the whey? were people eating the whey?
Yeah, well, initially, Neolithic adults were essentially universally lactose intolerant. Lactose is the milk sugar in milk that causes gastrointestinal problems, and,
mm-hmm.
and can be very dangerous for people who consume a lot of lactose and are lactose intolerant.
Okay.
You know, in terms of dehydration and diarrhea and you know, very, very destructive symptoms. So adults wouldn't have been drinking milk in Neolithic times, and during cheese making, when the whey separates off, it carries with it about 95% of the lactose in the milk.
Okay.
So the whey wouldn't have been consumed as a beverage by the adults either, because they would have the same lactose intolerance symptoms drinking the whey. And one of the reasons why cheese was conserved so meticulously once it was discovered is that it enabled the you know, a lot of the nutrition in milk, that enormous competitive advantage, to be available to the adult population, because the cheese is significantly lower in lactose. Okay. Much of it ends up in the whey, and the cheese became this precious food stuff that could be consumed in moderate amounts by adults. The very young children could consume the milk because they retain that ability to break down lactose. And they could consume the whey. But the whey, as far back as we can ascertain, has traditionally been used to feed the pigs, which have been part of this mixed agricultural scheme that starts in the Neolithic, of small ruminant sheep and goats, and then cow milk dairying, and small-scale crop cultivation, and pigs. And the Neolithic peoples always had this tripartite form of survival: the pigs, the milk and cheese, and then the cereal crops. And so the whey would go to the pigs, and that would then create this wonderful source of you know, protein and fat and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So what was Miss Muffet doing drinking curds and whey? Well, later on...
So she must have been little.
She was little.
Intolerant.
But not that little, but because by the time that nursery rhyme was concocted, adult lactose tolerance had been genetically developed for a long time in many regions of the globe that had a long dairying history, particularly in Europe north of the Alps. And I suspect that nursery rhyme comes from Europe north of the Alps. And once that capacity to digest lactose was acquired by adults, then whey could be ingested. And whey was in the Middle Ages, for example, medieval times, was a very important nutrient source in medieval population. Whey was consumed by humans as well as by the pigs.
Okay. Now, are you familiar with, there's a Vermont company that's making floor coverings using whey. Have you heard of that?
Sure. Yep. That's research that was done here at the University of Vermont,
okay.
and it spun off a company, and that's using, as I understand it, components from the whey that have some functional value in the floor covering.
Yeah.
So it's not whey itself, but it's whey components that are
the science
that are used. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Great.
Whey is used in lots of different foods and non-food uses. There's a lot of neat chemical functional components that have some really interesting health promoting benefits and so forth. A lot of the sports drinks are whey infused with different components.
Oh wow. Why has American cheese production been so cheddar-centric?
That's a great question, and it has to do with who the cheesemakers were that brought cheesemaking to this country. It was exclusively the New England colonies and the Massachusetts Bay Colony that attracted the demographics of the immigrants who were from the cheesemaking community. They were from regions in England that had been heavily developed in terms of cheese technology over the previous 300 years. So the Puritans who immigrate and form the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which then expands into the New England colonies, largely came from East Anglia, northeast of London, which had been the great, intensely developed region of England for hard-pressed cheesemaking in the 1500s, the 1400s, the 1500s, the early 1600s, just prior to the emigration to the New World, as well as a strong representation from the West Country, places like Somerset County, which is where cheddar cheesemaking arose. And so there was a strong representation of dairying and cheesemaking that flow into Massachusetts Bay and the New England colonies. And the agricultural system of New England was very fragile. It's not a great fertile region. And very quickly it was impossible to grow wheat and sustain it over long periods of time, which was the initial crop. Mm-hmm. Major crop, and wheat began to fail very quickly, and dairying follows in its wake because grass grows even in nutrient depleted soil, and so dairying rises, and the New England merchants are desperate to get into the trade network, and in order to have something to trade with, cheese and dairy products become part of the portfolio of agricultural products available to the merchants, along with particularly fish and salted fish and livestock products that get the merchants into this developing Atlantic trade system that the New England colonies desperately need to keep their economy going. And sadly, the system is focused on the West Indies, the sugar plantations that all the great European powers are developing in the Caribbean, and the English are developing it, particularly on Barbados. They were the first to really, really intensively develop sugar production, and they were among the first to replace the indentured servants that were coming from England to provide the labor on the sugar plantations with kidnapped African slaves. And so that system of agriculture, sugar plantation, heavily labor intensive, they needed food. New England could supply foods, cheese, butter, salted fish, livestock products, and a bustling trade begins, which then gets the New England merchants inputted into the sugar system, the rum production system, which is a byproduct of the sugar industry, and the New England merchants see rum as a potential cash crop. And suddenly, cheese and butter and wheat, what little wheat can be sent down there, fish, are being traded for rum and for molasses.
Okay.
To produce rum. And rum becomes a major part of the economy of New England. And again, cheese and butter are feeding into this system to allow it to be created. The rum then becomes the currency that allows the merchants to get into the slave trade and to become, you know, more deeply entrenched in this whole system of producing sugar to produce rum, to trade for slaves on the west coast of Africa, to replenish the labor supply of the West Indies sugar plantations, trade for more molasses and more rum, and this cycle, the so-called triangular trade cycle, goes on for over 100 years, and New England becomes fabulously wealthy.
And what Newport, year Rhode is Island. All of this starting?
This is by the late 1600s, the input into the slave trade begins, and, you know, the rum, the distilleries are being produced, you know, 150 or more distilleries on the coast of New England are being produced to process the molasses coming from the system, and cheese and butter are going down there through this and are part of the system, and it creates a cheesemaking emphasis on hard aged press type English cheeses. The initial cheese technology was largely Cheshire cheese, and that becomes American cheesemaking. And that type of hard-pressed English cheese then sets the stage for the next 200 years that eventually develops into cheddar cheese, a very similar related technology that we still see the imprint of that on our cheese system today in America. The cheddar cheese is still ubiquitous.
Yeah.
But it starts back then, and it was, you know, very much market-driven.
Yeah, okay.
And a tragic chapter in American history because of all of the social ills, you know, the injustice that occurred along with that. And you don't think of cheese history as intersecting with, you know, the misery and tragedy of that period, but it was part of the system.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the structure of the book. You begin each chapter with lines from Scripture. And it's amazing how much cheese is mentioned in the Bible. I didn't realize that. So can you talk about that? And also, to what extent are biblical mentions useful in establishing the history of cheese?
Yeah, one of the issues, you know, in trying to develop a book was, is there a unifying thread that can sort of link things together? You have that 9,000 years. The one thing I didn't want to have was a collection of trivia of you know, disparate facts that aren't linked together. There's lots of collections.
Don't know much about cheese,
but right. And so, you know, I was looking for sort of themes that seem to carry through. And it turns out there's, you know, a number of recurring themes over and over again that raise their head and influence cheesemakers and cheese in very significant ways. But one of the themes that came up really quickly, and it was of personal interest to me because of my own philosophical and spiritual and religious interests and background, was the biblical references that you mentioned that you know, cover different periods. That I said, you know, these give a window into you know, periods of prehistory and history that are really important, and it's a window that a lot of folks will be able to have some sense of understanding of, or will have some exposure to. That you know, and there's no question, you know, whatever your opinion of the Bible, there's no question that it has been a pivotal work of you know, literary work in Western civilization, and has been influential. And so it's if you're going to have a unifying theme for a book that deals with Western civilization and cheese in that context, that this would be a, you know, a good candidate. And so I began looking for examples for different periods that would help provide a unifying theme. And that was how that, you know, the use of epigraphs of you know, Bible verses to start out chapters, how that came about.
You know, it was interesting because even when you didn't mention cheese specifically, there are so many references to agriculture. And you can kind of understand what's going on. You know, Cain and Abel are watching over the herds.
Yeah, and there's actually, you know, there's anthropologists who really have keyed in on that you know, we think of the Genesis record. A lot of people think of it as pure myth, but anthropologically, there's a lot of really interesting information in there that if you start looking at the material records, the archaeological records and so forth, a lot of it makes sense, and Genesis provides a context. It's an ancient memory of prehistory, and it's really an interesting area of scholarship. And I had no idea that there was this anthropology that was really looking at Genesis as sort of a way to reconstruct and help inform that really critical period when the human species changes dramatically,
yeah.
And agriculture comes on the scene, and not just agriculture, but all these changes in human behavior that we take for granted that suddenly arise or really go into, you know, warp drive, to use a Star Trek analogy.
to go into the future.
and so, you know, I was really intrigued by that.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about that.
That was interesting. You refer in the book to American least cost food system, and I wanted to talk a little bit about what that means, and also how has that affected grassroots movements that focus on things like sustainable agriculture and organic foods, artisan foods, things like that.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it really, from the 19th century on, and particularly by the middle of the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution kicks in this country, and the Scientific Revolution in America kicks in, and we, you know, as a nation, begin to invest in science and technology. We set up, you know, land-grant university system and really elevate the role of science and technology in all of American culture and
mm-hmm.
life.
Mm-hmm.
And we're a culture of change. We've always have been, and adaption by necessity, and so in the food system, in cheese making, and all of agriculture, by the middle of the 19th century, new information, new science, new technology is coming online. New equipment, as a result of the Industrial Revolution, is coming online, and in cheese making, the factory system, which is enabled by new equipment, new technologies, new approaches, comes online in 1851, and by the end of the Civil War is just taking over cheese production in this country, as on-farm cheese making is withering very, very quickly. And that sets up this, what you mentioned as a least cost model, that the great advantage of technology and of economies of scale of producing products, any product on a larger scale, is cost savings in labor and in bulk purchasing of materials, and in fixed costs, lowering fixed costs, less duplication, and more consistent quality. And all those things were seen as real great advances, great benefits. And the factory was seen, the newly created factories in cheese and other food processing areas, and all of life in America was seen as really great steps forward, and that then opened the door to producing far vast increases in amounts of product, amounts of cheese,
mm-hmm. with line production
and so the abundance of food and cheese increases, and the price goes down because There's supply and demand principles, and especially in this country, supply and demand rules agricultural commodity pricing, especially in the 19th century. And so costs went down, and that then put pressure on cheesemakers. By the 1870s, all these small factories that had arisen very, very rapidly were now competing with each other for lower and lower price scales, and trying to survive, and the ones that could survive were the ones that got even larger and took advantage of the latest technology and the latest labor-saving devices and the larger scales, and so that there'd be a shake-up of the smaller cheesemakers dying off and the larger getting larger, and the supply and demand would come into more equilibrium. There was this constant pressure to get larger, and to those who got larger and reduced the costs were the ones that survived.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes on and on and on, and becomes more intense in the 20th century, particularly towards the second half of the 20th century. And by that point, cheese is being made, you know, 100,000 pounds of cheese a day, or further on, 500,000 pounds of cheese a day in a single factory. By the end of the 20th century,
say that again. How much?
500,000 pounds of cheese. A million pounds of cheese a day being made in a single factory, a single production factory. Wow. In a day, 10 million pounds of milk made into a million pounds of cheese. And they're being pushed because of the economies of scale. That brings the price down, and you know the competition among industrial cheesemakers is so intense that there's this pressure to get larger, to introduce labor-saving technology, to maximize cheese yields. And all of this means that the cheesemaker has to gain absolute control over the cheesemaking process and standardize and optimize and efficiency and so forth. And that results in, you know, changes in cheese that are not simply changes in the cost, very abundant low-cost cheese, but also, by and large, a more uniform cheese quality, less diversity, less differentiation among the major cheeses. And that then, that uniformity of cheese quality, and some would argue that that growth in blandness and less distinctiveness ultimately became part of the impetus for this backlash against industrial cheese making, industrial food production in general, to artisan, more traditional approaches and the wide spectrum of possibilities and flavors and textures that are possible with traditional technologies that are very difficult to duplicate on mass scales.
Mm-hmm.
And so the artisan revival since the, particularly after the counterculture revolution of the 60s and 70s, the hippie back to the land movement has just taken off and given new life to cheesemaking in this country and a lot of other places in the world where the same industrialization took place.
Yeah, it's so much fun to see, you know, all the farmers markets popping up and all the new products that are at each market. And
absolutely. And you know, I don't mean to be anti-large-scale cheesemaking. There's a place for all of these products, but I do have a particular place in my heart, and I'm an advocate for a very diverse cheesemaking landscape out there, and that we ought to be supporting these smaller-scale cheesemakers because they add so much to our food system, our way of life, our culture, as well as just quality of life and enjoyment.
And the quality of what we eat.
Quality of what we eat.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, we're winding down. I just have really one more question for you. I was wondering, from the standpoint of a writer, what was the greatest challenge of putting together this book, and what did you most enjoy about writing it?
Greatest challenge, really, it was like, you know, the proverbial onion, you peel off one layer and then, you know, it's layer upon layer upon layer that you know, I'd see a reference, you know, massive literature searches, scanning, you know, for little bits of information. I'd find a bit of information, a good example, a reference to a Sumerian goddess whose name was Inanna and
right.
cheese. And I had never heard of Inanna, and I had no information on Sumerian culture and cheese. And I started, you know, doing broad, you know, casting a very wide net on this in lots of different areas, and began to find all this information from different directions on Inanna and cheese. And it turns out that, you know, I spent months assembling all of this information and trying to get myself up to speed on Sumerian archaeology and Sumerian anthropology and civilization, and this becomes a key part of the story that links the Neolithic 7000 BC time that we talked about earlier with classical culture, Greek culture, Roman culture, and then into the Christian era and medieval culture, and you cannot understand those other periods without understanding Mesopotamia, because Mesopotamia was the start and had this enormous influence on everything that was to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, and I had to become at least enough versed in everything about Sumer and Sumerian culture to put that together, and it was exhausting. And that was just one example. You know, global climate change in 4th millennium B.C., you know, subboreal Atlantic period transition, you know, and its effect on paleobotany and anthropology and so forth. I didn't plan on doing that, and I got myself sucked into it. And it was just one thing after another.
Yeah.
And it was, as I mentioned, I lived on adrenaline as these new developments came. I said, wow, you know, look at this. I bet global climate change is really important. And, you know, you could see, man, that is really important to the human story. And it affected cheesemakers. And then, you know, environmental degradation, whoa, you know, and human spirituality and markets, and, you know,
yeah,
all these different things. And I'm not an expert in any of them.
So it's good that was exciting to you and that you didn't just find it completely overwhelming.
That's right. It was exciting. It was completely overwhelming. And there's so much more to be done. Much more work to be done.
Okay, great. And how about your greatest joy about writing the book? What was the best part of it for you?
Integrating it with my own personal passions that are not professional, which are history. I love history. Ever since I was a kid, I've loved history. Just any history.
Yeah.
And then my own religious beliefs and spiritual beliefs, my Christian beliefs, which I had no intention of weaving all that in because I didn't know it existed. But it was so exciting to, you know, to see that intersection of my own spiritual heritage.
Sure.
And it's intersection with cheese history.
Okay, great. Well, the book is Cheese and Culture by Paul S. Kinstedt. It's published by Chelsea Green. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Well, thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author and UVM professor Paul Kinstedt. This week's Write the Book prompt is to find an interesting lens through which to tell a story. Today on the show, for example, we heard about the history of the world as seen through the development of cheese in various cultures. And in mid-January, before joining WBTV, Write the Book had an interview that featured Gregor Hens, a German author whose new book, Nicotine, tells the story of his life seen through the lens of an addiction to cigarettes. So what lens can you offer to tell a story in a particularly unique and exciting way? Look at what you're working on and see if maybe there's a different way that you could be telling it that might offer some sort of framework for you that would be interesting to readers. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And just to remind you, even though we are new to WBTV, Write the Book has been going for 9 years. And so archived on that podcast site are some 400 interviews. I do occasional reruns, but there are certainly 300 and some unique interviews on that website. A lot of them are Vermonters. Many of them are not. Some are self-published writers. Some are very famous writers. It's been all over the place and a lot of fun. So I hope that you enjoy catching up on some of those. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, SheLaughsWithoutUs.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 993wbtv.org. That's Mondays at 3. The second hour, as I said before, will feature reruns and then possibly other new content eventually as yet to be designed. We'd love to hear your opinion about what should happen on the second hour of a show about books. Tune in or stream the show live. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm going to back up a minute here. I said tune in or stream the show live. That's actually something that I will be saying once we are broadcasting on 99.3 FM. At this point, we are just streaming. And again, the stream is at 99.3wbtv.org. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Have a great week.